C1PR. Number 17A.
Now, we come together on the Saturday just to discuss together and ponder together what we have been studying and pondering during the last 2 months. So we take it very easy and natural, and we don't strain about the whole subject. It seems that since we started with the chapter on prayer, that the world is very interested in the subject of prayer. Since we started, it seems that the time has been passing where nations turn to God in prayer to find a solution for the world situation or to help certain countries in their struggles. And the question of how to pray seems to be foremost in many people's hearts and minds. And in such a situation, I think it is a wonderful blessing for us to know that we know something about what constitutes a scientific prayer and not just what may be called a religious prayer, a blind prayer. And so some happiness really should pervade our whole heart, that we have the possibility and the opportunity to learn from the textbook something more definite, something more scientific about prayer. To learn to know what prayer is, and only knowing is power. And so only a prayer that is based on understanding is really a powerful prayer. And so I myself rejoice in the fact that Mrs. Eddy has given us such a wonderful explanation of what constitutes true and scientific prayer. And also I think we must see that it is worthwhile spending some part of our life, half a year or so of our life, only for the very subject of prayer, to investigate prayer. Because it seems that if we don't know how to pray, that we will never approach the infinite as he is, and therefore never have a real contact with God as he is, and therefore never come into coincidence with what he is. So it is worthwhile pondering this chapter over a certain period and rejoice in doing so. Because we learn from this first chapter how Mrs. Eddy says, well, prayer can also be a danger. And in certain cases she even says that prayer can be an evil. So we don't like to pray and be in danger that we pray something which is evil for us or for the world. We want to pray because it is good, and because we want to express good, and because it should bless the world. And therefore, we must know how to pray. And what we have done up to now is to investigate what constitutes prayer. What are the constituents of true prayer? And the very first thing we have investigated was that scriptural note which Mrs. Eddy gives, and which we have seen that this scriptural note pervades the whole chapter on prayer. That scriptural note, so to say, first depicts our whole attitude toward prayer. It depicts and characterizes our inward attitude with which to pray at all. And we have seen in the language of the Matrix that this attitude is characterized by the word of the word. It's characterized, say, through the synonymous term of mind, spirit, soul. But in what way? In what way is it characterized? And we have seen these three constituents of our attitude of mind, spirit, soul as first a desire, an inward desire. And second, we have seen that this desire must be substantialized through spiritual qualities, that this desire must be a firm, loving, consistent desire. It must be a desire which is expressed through spiritual qualities, what the spiritual qualities of firmness, of meekness, of patience, of loving kindness, and so on. You see, that it is not just a mental desire, but that it is a spiritual desire. So desire here is coupled with expressing spiritual qualities. And then third, we saw that Mrs. Eddy shows in that scriptural note that your Father knoweth what things ye have need of. It shows that this desire must be directed to that which our Father, which God knows. It mustn't be just a desire, an earnest desire towards an object which is not God. And so we can see how important it is that really the crux of this attitude here of prayer is the third. That in general, prayer is usually a desire. It may be a wish, it may be a desire. And second, in common prayer, it is also very often not only a superficial prayer, but also a prayer which is coupled with the best qualities in one's whole makeup and character. But the crux usually is that it is directed to an aim which is humanly conceived and humanly outlined, and not that third wonderful sense of the sinlessness of this prayer, where it says, no, our whole desire and whatever we put into it second must be directed to the God as he is. See, the third of soul must come in into the picture and identify that desire with a divine subject. Now, we know out of our experience very well that how prayer usually starts. It usually starts by wishing. And wishing what? That object which we humanly have figured out and which we humanly have outlined. And it may be that we pray for this and for that and for the other thing and for the other thing. Whereas the true, real attitude in prayer is only that attitude which goes out, hungering and thirsting after God. And after God as he is. And not after God as we conceive of. Because our conception of God may be limited, may be small, may be little. So, here we have to keep that in mind. That's the very first point, so to say, which that prayer tells us. And it is the attitude of prayer, the word as the word. And let's be clear about it, that when we pray, that we are checking, so to say, our desire and see if they are really in line with this divine order of desire, which is real in our heart, and third, which goes forth after God as he is. And God is all. God is depicted as all. Any other prayer that wishes something else than that is not a scientific prayer. It's an enormous thing. We can see how it demands of the petitioner a bigness of caliber, that we must have a bigness of character, because it demands something of us to put all our personal wishes aside and say, no, I turn myself to one aim, one direction, to the allness of God. I have been told that desire, the word desire, comes from a Latin and old French, has an old Latin and French derivation, which means to go out for the stars. You see, and it's quite difficult. Desire is more than a wish. We can wish about anything. But desire is always that which goes out for the infinite, where we hitch our wagon to the stars, where all our whole attitude, mental attitude, where our whole quality, spiritual qualities in our attitude, just goes out for only one aim, that big, far-reaching aim of God as all. So, having seen this point, we may in future be out of danger to approach in prayer God with our own outlined and defined wishes. You know, from your experience with talking to other people and so on very well, that one hears, well, it's only right that I should get this and that. It's only right that God should solve this problem in this and this way. See, it's outlining. It's humanly outlining. We may do that outlining with a very good human intention, but it's human. And as long as we feel, well, it's only right that God should give me this and that, it's only right that it should work out this and that way, we outline and we leave that attitude of the world as the world. And as we leave the attitude of the world as the world, naturally, prayer loses its divine power. In fact, we can see what we do if we put forward our own human conception of what is right and wrong. When we do that, we really give the Christ no chance to work on us. If we outline in our desires, our wishes, if we outline that, then we shut out the infinite possibilities of God speaking to us. And so, one of the most wonderful things of prayer is that one can say, not my will be done, but thine will be done, whatever thy will is, and to have that openness of mind and of desire which says, I don't know the answer, I don't need to know the answer, I only know one thing, namely that if I approach God in the right way, that he gives the answer, and the right answer, and that answer is more right and bigger and larger and grander than what I can perceive humanly. So, in taking the right attitude of the word as the word, I give really a right chance to the word as the Christ. I give really a right chance for the Christ to talk to me and come into me and sup with me and present his answer and not fulfill my request. It's nice to see also if one goes through Mrs. Eddy's works and see and ask, Well, what does she say what our need is? And there are very few references really to a true need, what the true need is. And one of the very few references where she puts it positively is that one in prayer where you know that it is what we most need is the fervent desire for growth in grace. See, it's the fervent desire that we grow towards the grace of God. It isn't that she says, well, what you really need is this and this and this and this and this, and counts up all the human needs. She doesn't. It's always a spiritual need, and it's always big. Or she says in Miscellany, one thing is eternally here, it reigns supreme today, tomorrow, forever. We need it in our homes, at our firesides, on our altars, for with it win we the race of the century. We have it only as we live it. This is that needful one thing, divine science. That's the need, which has to be met. Whereby thought, mind, is spiritualized. That's spirit. Reaching outward and upward. You hinge your wagon to the stars. Outward and upward to the signs. See, it identifies that thought which puts every spiritual quality into it. For what? For that one purpose of identifying ourselves with the subject of God. Here it is to the science in Christianity, the science in medicine, the science in physics, and science in metaphysics. That's the needful one thing. Now, we can see the practicability of understanding properly such a proposition as she puts here. Because we know in the practice, in talking with other people, the very first thing is always a wrong attitude of the word of the world. Wishing something which is not divine science or God as the all. We always wish something else. That means that the concept of prayer is something different. It's vaster, it's wider, it's grander. It's the all. And that is, I think, it's the beauty. And only if we reach out to the all can come to us. If we don't reach out to the all cannot come to us. And so this needful one thing is to see what we really need. She says in the beginning of the chapter that prayer is an unselfed love. I don't think that she uses that term unselfed very often. I think here it's about the only time. I'm not quite sure, but I only know when I looked it up that it was either the only time or just a few times. The unselfed love. It is not unselfish. It's more than that. It's unself. It goes away right away from self. That prayer doesn't want to have anything to do with the self. It goes out for the one big self, the divine self, the divine ego, which is always characterized by soul. And so prayer is that unselfed love where we just put aside all what is called our immediate human needs and wants and say, no, I go to God. I am not going to Allah. I'm going to God. And then I take the right attitude of the word as the word. Well, that summarizes perhaps what we have seen as the scriptural notes and what they contain. Then we have taken the subject as such. We have taken the first prayer, which we may have epitomized as that prayer where we are wise enough the prayer of wisdom, very wise in us, to reach out for God as he is, and not as he is not, where we seek the fulfillment of what God is as he is, and consequently, where we do not seek the fulfillment of what we wish. That first prayer is that prayer of bigness, which stands against wishful thinking, which stands against calling on God that he fulfills what we have defined as our need. In that first prayer, we felt a great sense of the allness of God, the isness of God, the unchangeability of God. It pervades a tremendous sense of allness and infinitude. And it says more or less, well, seek for this all and infinite, and then the all and infinite will reveal itself to us. That's our reward, that it will come to us. And so we also could feel that this first prayer is the prayer of bigness. You know, that's so important because the human mind always likes to think in smallness, is narrow, has narrow tendencies, narrow aims, narrow purposes, narrow ways. It is interested in narrow little things. Here, right at the beginning of the textbook, we get that vastness of infinitude, where we say, why should we seek for a little if we can seek the all? Why take the little if we can have the all? We tried to pin down this prayer. Prayer has always an answer. That's why we pray. Prayer must always have an answer. And so, trying to find what law is depicted in this first prayer, we felt the law is this, that if I open my thoughts wider and wider and wider, if I seek God as the all, what comes back to me was in that text always what I would call the promise or the vision of the allness of mind. That's what I get first. I don't get a motor car, I don't get a better job, I don't get anything of that sort. What is presented there is that I get a higher, wider, fuller promise, a real promise, the promise in the clouds. So it shows us the law of how to start, if we want to find. It says, as I seek, that holds the finding in itself, the answer. My first prayer is to seek God as the all, and in that seeking is already the finding. They are not separate. And in the text we can see through every paragraph that always the promise is there. But that seeking is shown as a seeking through the subtle. I don't think I will go into it, just not to make it too involved. But you know how the subtones have no other office but to define the seeking. To define how to keep the seeking pure and meek and bringing it into harmony with the being, and how that opens up the infinite resources from which is always pouring forth more than we accept. And that is always the right answer and is always a fulfilled answer. Now I have just said the whole seven through without knowing it, wanting it. See, it's always that wonderful sense of if I keep the prayer, the approach of prayer pure, it always gives me the promise of life, truth and love, which is full. fullness, rightness, and completion or solution. So that's the first prayer. Then we went to the second prayer. And in that second prayer, what do we need more after this first prayer? She comes in and says right at the beginning, well, but this divine being must not stand just as a promise somewhere in the clouds, somewhere far away. It must be brought down to where I am. The divine being must be reflected by men. And so I come to quite a different subject of prayer, where it is shown how to reflect God. And in its simplest and initial stages, where we are in the chapter on prayer, we are not in the later chapters, reflection here is shown as the expression of spiritual qualities. I say qualities, not ideas. Expression of spiritual qualities. We remember how in that second prayer we had a whole list of all the different spiritual qualities of which she said, well, we must express those, like consecration, like gratitude, keeping the commandments, love, sincerity, meekness, patience, watchfulness. We spoke about devotion, about struggling to be always good, longing to be better. You see, it's expressing quality. That's the second. See, we can't leave it at the first prayer where we just seek and behold. Now comes the second of spirit which says, yes, but we have to take that in that vision and clothe that vision with the substance of spirit. Here to clothe that vision with the best spiritual qualities which we have already. With all the love which we have already, with the gratitude which we have already, and the meekness which we have already, and so give to that seeking substance. That's the second prayer. It stands therefore against the false sense of prayer, which is just outward worship, material worship, you see, which is empty worship. How empty are our conceptions of deity, she says there. It shows that the second prayer, that we must put our best qualities into laboring for what we ask. And so we could see in that second chapter, in that second subject, what she says, what this will do. And in one of the questions which we had on the questionnaire, we found out that time and time and time again she said that putting spiritual qualities into following up our desire brings something to us. And what it brought to us was progress, success, growth, the unfoldment, strengthening. You could see the birth going on. That it brought something in us which is going to strengthen in us, something which is going to unfold, something spiritual in us. And so I feel that what she gives here as a law, the law of the second prayer, is to say, what do I pray, what do I give to God, is my spiritual worship, whatever is comprised under that term, under worship, like loving the idea, like being meek about it, and consistent about it, consecrated about it, and devoted about it, that I put into it, you see, that's what I give to God, and says what comes back is a new birth, is unfoldment, progress. That seems to be the law of spirit in the chapter on prayer.